On the afternoon of the sixth day of the festival, Pharaoh moved in solemn procession from his villa in the midst of the royal estates in the open country between Karnak and Luxor, down the ceremonial avenue lined with statues of granite lions, to the temple of Osiris on the bank of the Nile. The great sledge on which he rode was so tall that the dense crowds lining the avenue were forced to strain their necks backwards to look up at him on his great gilded throne as he trundled by, drawn by 20 pure white bullocks with massive humped shoulders and wreaths of flowers on their horned heads. The skids of the sledge ground harshly over the paving and scarred the stone slabs. 100 musicians led the procession, strumming the lyre and the harp, beating the cymbal and the drum, shaking the rattle and the sistrum, and blowing on the long straight horn of the oryx and on the curling horn of the wild ram. A choir of 100 of the finest voices in Egypt followed them, singing hymns of praise to Pharaoh and that other god, Osiris. Naturally, I led the choir. Behind us followed an honour guard from the Blue Crocodile Regiment, led by Tanos himself. The crowds raised a special cheer for him. As all plumed and armoured, he strode past. The unmarried maidens shrieked, and more than one of them sank swooning in the dust, overcome by the hysteria that his new-won fame engendered. Behind the guard of honour came the vizier and his high office-bearers, then the nobles and their wives and children, then a detachment of the Falcon Regiment, and finally Pharaoh's great sledge. In all, this was an assembly of several thousand of the most wealthy and influential persons in the Upper Kingdom. As we approached the temple of Osiris, the abbot and all his priests were drawn up on the staircase between the tall entrance pylons to welcome Pharaoh Mahmoza. The temple had been freshly painted, and the bas-relief on the outer walls was dazzling with colour in the warm yellow glow of the sunset. A gay cloud of banners and flags fluttered from their poles set in the recesses of the outer wall. At the base of the staircase, Pharaoh descended from his carriage, and in solemn majesty began to climb up the 100 steps. The choir lined both sides of the staircase. I was on the 50th step, and so I was able to study the king minutely during the few seconds that it took for him to pass close to me. I already knew him well, for he had been a patient of mine, but I had forgotten how small he was, that is, small for a god. He stood not as tall as my shoulder, although the high double crown made him seem much more impressive. His arms were folded across his chest in the ritual posture, and he carried the crook and the flail of his royal office and his godhead. I remarked, as I had before, that his hands were hairless, smooth, and almost feminine, and that his feet also were small and neat. He wore rings on all his fingers and on his toes, amulets on his upper arms and bracelets on his wrists. The massive pectoral plate of red gold on his chest was inlaid with many colours of faience depicting the god Thoth, bearing the feather of truth. That piece of jewellery was a splendid treasure, almost 500 years old, and had been worn by 70 kings before him. Under the double crown, his face was powdered dead white like that of a corpse. His eyes were dramatically outlined with startling jet black, and his lips were rouged crimson. Under the heavy make-up, his expression was petulant, and his lips were thin and straight and humourless. His eyes were shifty and nervous, as well they might be, I reflected. The foundations of this great house of Egypt were cracked, and the kingdom riven and shaken. Even a god has his worries. Once his domain had stretched from the sea across the 7 mouths of the delta, southwards to Aswan and the First Cataract, the greatest empire on earth. He and his ancestors had let it all slip away, and now his enemies swarmed at his shrunken borders, clamouring like hyena and jackal and vulture to feast on the carcass of our Egypt. In the south were the black hordes of Africa. In the north, along the coast of the Great Sea, were the piratical sea people, and along the lower reaches of the Nile, the legions of the false pharaoh. In the west were the treacherous Bedouin and the sly Libyan, while in the east new hordes seemed to rise up daily, their names striking terror into a nation grown timid and hesitant with defeat. Assyrians and Medes, Kassites and Hurrians and Hittites. There seemed no end to their multitudes. What advantage remained in our ancient civilization if it were grown feeble and effete with its great age? How were we to resist the barbarian in his savage vigour, his cruel arrogance and his lust for rapine and plunder? I was certain that this pharaoh, like those who had immediately preceded him, was not capable of leading the nation back to its former glories. He was incapable even of breeding a male heir. This lack of an heir to the empire of Egypt seemed to obsess him even more than the loss of the empire itself. He had taken 20 wives so far. They had given him daughters, a virtual tribe of daughters, but no son. He would not accept that the fault lay with him as sire. He had consulted every doctor of renown in the upper kingdom and visited every oracle and every important shrine. I knew all this because I was one of the learned doctors he had been sent for. I admit that at the time I had felt some trepidation in prescribing to a god, and that I had wondered why he should need to consult a mere mortal on such a delicate subject. Nevertheless, I had recommended a diet of bull's testicles fried in honey, and counselled him to find the most beautiful virgin in Egypt, and take her to his marriage bed within a year of the first flowering of her woman's moon. I had no great faith in my own remedy, but bull's testicles, when cooked to my recipe, are a tasty dish, while I reckoned that the search for the most beautiful virgin in the land might distract Pharaoh and prove not only amusing but pleasurable as well. From a practical point of view, if the king bedded a sufficient number of young ladies, then surely one of them must eventually drop a male pup into his harem. Anyhow, I consoled myself that my treatment was not as drastic as some of the others proposed by my peers, particularly those disgusting remedies dreamed up by the quacks in the Temple of Osiris who call themselves doctors. If not actually efficacious, my recommendations would at least do no harm. And that was what I believed. How wrong the fates would prove me. And if only I had known the consequences of my folly, I would have taken Todd's place in the pageant rather than have given Pharaoh such frivolous counsel. I was amused and flattered when I heard that Pharaoh must have taken my advice seriously, and that he'd ordered his nomarchs and his governors to scour the length of the land from El Amarna to the cataracts to find bulls with succulent balls, and any virgin who might fit my specifications for the mother of his first son. My sources at the king's court informed me that he had already rejected hundreds of aspiring applicants for the title of the most beautiful virgin in the land. Then the king was swiftly past me and gone into the temple to the keening of the priests and the obsequious bobbing of the abbot. The grand vizier and all his train followed closely, and then there was an undignified rush of lesser citizens to find places from which to watch the passion play. Space in the temple was limited. Only the mighty and the noble and those rich enough to bribe the thieving priests were allowed into the inner courtyard. The others were forced to watch through the gates from the outer court. Many thousands of the citizenry would be disappointed and would have to be content with a second-hand account of the pageant. Even I, the impresario, had great difficulty in fighting my way through the press of humanity, and I only succeeded when Tanos saw my predicament and sent two of his men to rescue me and force a path for me into the precincts reserved for the actors. Before the pageant could begin, we were obliged to endure a succession of flowery speeches, firstly from the local functionaries and government ministers, and then from the Grand Vizier in person. This interlude of speechifying gave me the opportunity to make certain that all the arrangements for the pageant were perfect. I went from tent to tent, checking the costumes and the make-up of each of my actors, and soothing last-minute attacks of temperament and stage fright. The unfortunate Todd was nervously dreading the possibility that his performance might not please my Lord Intef. I was able to assure him that it most certainly would. And then I administered to him a draught of the red chepen, which would deaden the pain that he was about to have inflicted upon him. When I came to Rasfa's tent, he was drinking wine with two of his cronies from the palace guard, and with a whetstone laying an edge on his short bronze sword. I had created his make-up to render him even more repulsive, which was not an easy feat given the high plateau of ugliness from which we started. I realized how well I had succeeded as he leered at me with blackened teeth and offered me a cup of the wine. "How does your back feel now, pretty boy? Have a taste of a man's drink. Perhaps it'll give you balls again." I am accustomed to his taunts, and I kept my dignity as I told him that my Lord Intef had countermanded the abbot's orders, and that the first act was to be played out in the original form. "I have spoken to Lord Intef already." He held up the sword. "Feel the edge, eunuch. I want to make certain that it meets with your approval." I left him feeling a little queasy. Although Tanus would not be on stage until the second act, He was already in costume. Relaxed and smiling, he clasped my shoulder. "Well, old friend, this is your opportunity. After this evening, your fame as a playwright will spread throughout Egypt." "As yours has already. Your name is on every lip," I told him. But he laughed it away with careless modesty as I went on. "Do you have your closing declamation prepared, Tanos? Would you like to recite it to me now?" Traditionally, the actor who played Horace would close the pageant with a message to Pharaoh, ostensibly from the gods, but in reality from his own subjects. In olden times, this had been the one occasion during the year when the populace, through the agency of the actor, could bring to the king's notice matters of concern which they were not able to address to him at any other time. However, during the rule of this last dynasty of kings, the tradition had fallen away, and the closing speech had become merely another eulogy to the divine Pharaoh. For days past, I had been asking Tanos to rehearse his speech for me, but every time he had put me off with excuses so lame that I was by now thoroughly suspicious of his intentions. "This is the last opportunity," I insisted, but he laughed at me. "I have decided to let my speech be as much a surprise to you as I hope it will be to Pharaoh. That way you should both enjoy it more," and there was nothing I could do to persuade him. At times he can be far and away the most headstrong and obstinate young ruffian I have ever encountered. I left him in not a little dudgeon and went to find more convivial company. As I stooped in through the entrance of Lostri's dressing tent, I froze with shock. Even though I had designed her costume myself and instructed her handmaidens as to exactly how I wanted her powder and rouge and eye paint applied, still I was not prepared for the ethereal vision that stood before me now. For a moment I was convinced that another miracle had taken place, and that the goddess had indeed risen up from the underworld to take my mistress' place. I gasped aloud, and actually began to sink to my knees in superstitious awe when my mistress giggled and roused me from my delusion. "Isn't this fun? I cannot wait to see Tanos in full costume. I am sure he must look like the god himself." She turned slowly to allow me to appraise her own costume, smiling at me over her shoulder. "No more godlike than you, my lady," I whispered. "When will the play begin?" she demanded impatiently. "I'm so excited that I can wait no longer." I cocked my ear to the panel of the tent and listened for a moment to the drone of the speeches in the great hall. I realized that this was the final oration, and that at any moment my lord Intef would call upon my players to perform. I took Lostri's hand and squeezed it. "Remember the long pause and the haughty look before you begin your opening speech," I cautioned her. And she slapped my shoulder playfully. "Away with you, you old fusspot. It'll all go perfectly, you'll see." And at that moment I heard my lord Intef's voice raised. "The divine god Pharaoh Mamoza, the great house of Egypt, the support of the realm, the just, the great, the all-seeing, the all-merciful." The titles and honorifics continued while I hurried out of Lostri's tent and made my way to my opening position behind the central pillar. I peered around the column and saw that the inner courtyard of the temple was packed, and that Pharaoh and his senior wives sat in the front rank on low benches of cedar wood, sipping cool sherbet or nibbling dates and sweetmeats. My lord Intef was addressing them from the front of the raised platform, below the altar that was our stage. The main body of the stage was still hidden from the audience by the linen curtains. I surveyed it for one last time, although it was too late to do anything further about it now. Behind the curtains, the set was decorated with palms and acacia trees from the palace gardens, and transplanted under my instruction. Masons had been taken from the work on the king's tomb to build a stone cistern at the back of the temple from which a stream could be diverted across the stage to represent the river Nile. At the rear of the stage, hanging from floor to ceiling, were tightly stretched sheets of linen on which the artists from the necropolis had painted marvellous landscapes. In the half-light of the dusk and the flicker of the torches in their brackets, the effect was so realistic as to transport the beholder into a different world in a distant time. There were other delights that I had prepared for Pharaoh's amusement, from cages of animals, birds and butterflies that would be released to simulate the creation of the world by the great god Amon-Ra, to flares and torches that I had doctored with chemicals to burn with brilliant flames of crimson and green, and flood the stage with eerie light and smoke clouds, like those of the underworld where the gods lived. "Mamoza, son of Ra, may you be granted eternal life. We, your loyal subjects, the citizens of Thebes, beg you to draw nigh and give your divine attention to this poor play that we dedicate to your majesty." My Lord Intef concluded his address of welcome and resumed his seat. To a fanfare of hidden ram's horns, I stepped out from behind the pillar and faced the audience. They had endured discomfort and boredom on the hard flagstones and by now were ripe for the entertainment to begin. A raucous cheer greeted my entrance, and even Pharaoh smiled in anticipation. I held up both hands for silence, and only when it was total did I begin to speak my overture. While I walked in the sunlight, young and filled with the vigour of youth, I heard the fatal music in the reeds by the bank of the Nile. I did not recognise the sound of this harp, and I had no fear, for I was in the full bloom of my manhood and secure in the affection of my beloved. The music was of surpassing beauty. Joyously I went to find the musician, and could not know that he was Death, and that he played his harp to summon me alone. We Egyptians are fascinated by death, and I had at once touched a deep chord within my audience. They sighed and shuddered. Death seized me, and bore me up in his skeletal arms towards Amon-Ra, the sun god, and I was become one with the white light of his being. At a great distance I heard my beloved weep, but I could not see her, and all the days of my life were as though they had never been. This was the first public recitation of my prose, and I knew almost at once that I had them. Their faces were fascinated and intent. There was not a sound in the temple.